This is the fourth day of this October 2010 seven-day session, and we'll pick up again with the teachings of Japanese Zen Master Basui from a book called Mud and Water, translated by Arthur Braverman. Questioner, what does it mean when someone carves an image of a stupa or a Buddha and makes rubbings from it daily, calling it religious practice? So this is apparently was one of the secondary practices in the time of Basui. Basui takes very broad-minded view of this. This, too, is seeing into one's own nature. And he says that when you let's read it. When you realize your own Buddha nature by yourself, the seal will be transmitted. It is like making rubbings of wooden Buddha images. Past and present Buddhas are all like this. Mind is transmitted through mind and nothing more. And the stupa is Buddha nature. And then he says, it is said in a sutra, one look at a stupa and you are eternally separated from the three evil paths. We're not told what sutra that is. Again, the three evil paths are the three lowest of the six realms of unenlightened existence. So, allegedly, one look at a sutra and you're in the clear for those three low realms. And then Basui says, if one were to take these teachings from the Buddhist sutra literally and give discourses on them to others, and if these people were to believe this literal interpretation, they would think that every look at a stupa would bring them prolonged freedom from evil paths. They would then feel that they need do nothing more than look upon an existing material stupa. So he's obviously poo-pooing this kind of superstitious idea. And he goes on, if, as is written in this sutra, one look upon a stupa will bring prolonged freedom from evil paths, who, birds and beasts as well as humans, would not look upon a stupa? And would anyone fall into the three evil paths? If this literal interpretation of the sutra were true, why would anyone be afraid to misbehave? And why would anyone throw away the pleasures of this world to become a monk or a nun, follow the precepts, perform ascetic practices, and search for a good teacher? As for this statement, a look at a stupa brings prolonged freedom from the three evil paths, it means that one who looks directly into his inherent nature will attain prolonged liberation. Never listen to the talk of those who say there is a way other than looking into your own true nature. I think there are many of us who came to Zen because there's so little in Zen that partakes of superstition and magic. But even in Zen, there's a place for those who might believe these things. And the important thing is not what you believe, but what you do, and that you sit. And then he goes on, though the mind of ordinary people is clear and one with the Buddhas and patriarchs, unable to believe it, you fail to rid yourself of attachment to form. Therefore, you transmigrate through the six realms, binding yourself and enduring pain. He says you fail to rid yourself of attachment to form. It's important to understand that attachment to form doesn't just mean physical form, but to thought forms as well. But that's form. As soon as we have a word or a thought, there's some form to it. And those are the real troublesome attachments, is our attachments to thought forms, to notions and opinions. So attachment to form is far more than a materialistic. It's far more treacherous than just being attached to an ice cream cone or something. Duh. Suppose, for example, you were to arouse your aspiration and perform severe ascetic practices. Now, you know, I'm a little uncomfortable with this. Basui, this is now the second time he's referred to performing ascetic practices in a way that sounds approving. The Buddha rejected asceticism. But let's just go with this. Suppose you were to arouse your aspiration and perform a severe ascetic practices. If you desired to harmonize yourself with the path of no mind while still harboring feelings of attachment to form, it would be like starting a fire by striking a rock at the bottom of the ocean. Though it is a rock at the bottom of the ocean, if you take it, put it upon land, and then strike it, you will immediately produce a flame. Though every rock is equipped with the nature of fire, as long as it is submerged in water, it cannot give rise to flames. All people are equipped with the inclination to spiritual awakening, yet without removing the feeling of attachment to all form, they cannot give rise to this awakening. Do you see why it is said, though Buddha nature manifests itself magnificently, those who have feelings of attachment to form cannot see it? So it's another nifty metaphor for the fact that in our essential nature we lack nothing to awaken to this true nature, because we are this true nature. This is another section we're starting now. Still, of course, Basui speaking here. Before Basso had penetrated enlightenment, Basso is the Japanese name for Ma Zu, great, great enlightened teacher of the early Tang Dynasty, who was said to have had 139 enlightened disciples. Before Basso had penetrated enlightenment, he lived in the mountains, practicing sitting meditation for long periods, never lying down. Speaking of ascetic practices, this is one that actually was, maybe still is, held in quite high regard in China, which is never lying down. So, going sometimes allegedly for years without lying down. The Zen master Ejo went there and started polishing a tile in front of Basso's hermitage, saying he was going to make it into a mirror. He laughed at Basso for sitting in quiet meditation with the intention of becoming a Buddha, while not understanding what he, Ejo, was pointing out by his action. As a result of Ejo's laughter, Basso was immediately enlightened. Yeah, so this is a story that has become quite famous in Zen lore. I don't remember the laughter part, but where Ejo, the senior monk, could see that Basso was attached to the idea of sitting as a cause and enlightenment as the effect. There is a causal connection between sitting and enlightenment, but there's also an acausal connection. The sitting is effect at the same time. It's the sitting and enlightenment are one. That sitting is the actualization of our enlightened nature. And that Basso, Ejo could see that Basso was obsessed, maybe, with the thought that enlightenment way out there in the future is something he could reach if only he did enough sitting. So he goes on, as a result of Ejo's laughter, Basso was immediately enlightened. Had Ejo not gone there and showed this to him, Basso would have kept sitting in quiet meditation, passing his time in vain. In other words, what did Ejo do? He just broke up a notion in Basso's mind that had become an obstruction, an obstacle, a dichotomy. Here I am, this unenlightened slob, just doing the best I can, and if only I could get up to enlightenment, which is in the future, some other place. That's the delusion. So his larger point, Basui's larger point, is that if we're isolated, if we carry on our practice in isolation, we run the risk of having wrong ideas, obstructive notions calcify. Zen has always been primarily a practice involving a mentor. Because without a mentor, it is so easy to get caught in one's own fixed ideas. Basui continues, from ancient times up to the present, no one who has gone to live alone in the mountains before having attained enlightenment or having met a teacher of superior ability has ever passed on the wisdom of the Buddhas and patriarchs. Though 10 million people may gather together, if the source is not deep, the river will not flow for long. That is why all those who aspire to the way discard mothers, fathers, teachers, and elders, do not consider 1,000 miles a long distance, are not concerned about hunger or cold, and seek out good teachers. When they come into contact with a teacher, some realize enlightenment after a time, establish a mutual rapport, and leave after receiving verification of their attainment. Others, after a word from the master, begin to understand the import of his message. And there are others who, after believing even to a small degree, put down their walking sticks and place their aspirations right there. Some work tirelessly, supervising the running of the monastery. Others eat the fruit of trees and wear grass robes. And others eat one meal a day while their lives hang from thin threads. We read about these kinds of austere practices in the, I think, the last sesshin, in Hakuin, where he talked about all of these serious monks who would eat very little each day because there wasn't much food to be eaten. Basui, feeling no shame, though they are ridiculed and admonished, concentrating on the important matter of life and death, these people let their deluded minds wither, forget their own egos, take no pride in their understanding or attainment, practice rigorously to the point of forgetting the flavor of food, and travel on pilgrimages, forgetting they are walking. In other words, in a samadhi state. These people let their deluded minds wither. It's kind of a good word to describe what happens through long zazen. Is the energy of this discursive mind that gives rise to this persistent notion of a self, and this energy withdraws, in a sense. The ego notion is deprived of life. Life being our attention. The more we dwell in our thoughts, especially the thoughts of self, the I, the me, and the my, the more we dwell in our thoughts, the more we nurture the ego. And so when we withdraw our attention from our thoughts, then this nuisance, illusion, withers. It, of course, doesn't mean that it affects your functioning. You become dysfunctional because your ego is deprived of all the attention that it craves. But on the contrary, when we can get the obsession with the I, the me, and the my, we can get it out of the way, then we can function much more effectively, because we're always getting tripped up by our self-centeredness, our, what one person called, our basic human narcissism. How could it be anything but helpful to get rid of that? He goes on talking about these heroic practitioners. They do not collect sayings or phrases of the ancient masters. Their true desire is only to meet a teacher. Since their sole intention is the complete understanding of the great matter, they do not limit themselves to 30 or 40 years. Though their hair turns white and their teeth turn yellow, they do not become idle. When they penetrate directly to the source, even after they receive verification from a good teacher, they do not get caught in their own glory or superiority. Some may leave, retiring deep in the mountains, burying their names in a ravine, eating boiled wild roots, nourishing their spirits, not pursuing fame. Others may stay near their teachers and serve them, never seeking the ultimate quiet of sitting idly by themselves. I like this phrase especially. They do not limit themselves to 30 or 40 years. The best thing we can do to nourish a strong practice is to take the long view, is to get away from our craving for the quick fix and just make this practice incorporated into our lives thoroughly so that it can saturate us. And that takes time. To take this long view truly is to become indomitable, invulnerable. We won't lose heart when our practice is flagging, when we feel flat or discouraged, because we know it'll pass. We know it's a mind state. It's like a weather system. This is what we encounter in Sesshin too. Sesshin is just taking long practice and accelerating it in the course of a week. And in that accelerated progress, we pass through these different mind states of discouragement and so forth. Key thing is to see that they are transitory. He goes on, I've never heard of anyone who, making this kind of true religious practice his prime objective, did not penetrate the truth. They all promoted this vital wisdom of the Buddhas and patriarchs. Though they lived in peace and quiet, they could not refrain from appearing in society as a light of direction on a dark road, planting seeds of wisdom in the 10,000 worlds. Aren't these people, in fact, true transmitters of Buddha's grace? So here he brings in the Bodhisattva ideal. Though they lived in peace and quiet for a while, they could not refrain from emerging and moving out into the world to be guides to others. The quintessential model of this was Siddhartha himself. When he came to his great supreme awakening, we're told that he sat for 7 weeks just savoring the indescribable joy of this deep awakening. His sitting was pure joy. So why did he have to get up and trudge through northern India for the next 45 years? Because he couldn't do otherwise. He couldn't keep this incomparable Dharma to himself. He had to share it with others and relieve suffering in the world. So he goes on, how incredible. Today's students of the way are of inferior character and their aspiration is superficial. They give no thought to the truth of the great matter of life and death. Though they go to teachers everywhere, they don't want to penetrate completely all the way to the bottom. They only care about their relation to the teacher and his name, not knowing whether he is a teacher of the right law or a heretic. They count names, journey to the east, west, north, and south, and take pride in having met many teachers. Some may, for example, place their faith in one locality, spending a summer in a training session there. During the summer period, however, they just spend their time preparing for their pilgrimage following that training period. Some may consider a place to do a combination summer and winter session, counting the days and hence making 90 days pass slowly. It's like we know from sitting, if you're counting the minutes to the end of the round, it's going to pass, time's going to pass slowly. Others, this gives us a little peek into the characters, different kinds of monks in Basui's time. Others may keep a pouch containing a handwritten chart of the lineage of a Buddhist tradition, wearing it around their necks as proof of their attainment. Or they may hold on to sacred relics, putting the related implements in order, secretly forming groups of 3 to 5 people, constructing pagodas to put the relics in. They then view these relics together, expressing their strong desire for the most rare and precious among them, and discoursing on the superiority and inferiority of them. Some burn their bodies, arms, or fingers, severely inflicting pain upon themselves, and getting those who train at the same retreat all worked up, engaging them in useless activities as they themselves neglect their religious practice. This is something we read about in the old texts in China, is monks who supposedly, to show their great ardor for the Dharma, would burn or cut off fingers. Others embrace the gathering of followers, become attached to their lay names, artistic skills, and family names. Still others cannot completely rid themselves of the path of duty. Not sure what he means by that. As a result, they lose sight of attentive practice, hold on to their own thoughts and opinions, and indifferently assess the Buddha Dharma. Though they try to surpass others with Zen stories and defeat them in question-answer combat, they do not have the power of seeing into their own nature and therefore collect paradoxical words and clever expressions from old masters and keep them in secret, showing them to no one. Using these words and expressions, they write poems and songs and take pleasure in adding their own critical comments to the words of the masters. Through the clever use of words, they try to defeat their fellow practitioners. These are all examples of the way of heretics. We see at work here what has long been respected in Zen is on the part of teachers is revealing the truth also by exposing the false. To point out, to be specific about the kind of errors that can creep into any community or any individual. The mixed up ideas, the attachments. That's what they are. They're attachments. All kinds of attachments. So many kinds of attachments we can find ourselves caught in. what another Buddhist teacher called spiritual materialism. Basui continues on in this vein. Others, when they first arouse the mind that seeks the way, keep the precepts, persevere in zazen, and perform spiritual practices. When they can keep their thoughts under control for a while, they say they can clearly see their original face. Since this original face has no ego, they say, no being, no Buddha, and no Dharma, what should be called precepts? They ignore the laws of cause and effect and treat the alms they receive as unimportant. Eating the five spicy foods and drinking liquor, they become wild, abuse the Buddhas and patriarchs, condemn good teachers everywhere, and criticize things of the past as well as the present. They shout and chatter at length, joke and laugh, sport in the mountains and at sea, spend the day reciting Japanese and Chinese poems, and admire a refined atmosphere with fine flowers. Meeting others and seeing what they possess, they desire it for themselves. Not caring about their own appearance, nor whether they are with laymen or monks, being indifferent to the occasion, they love to talk Zen and wish only to be victorious in Zen combat. When I read these accounts and many times in Sesshin and various texts, we've read of such descriptions of misguided monks, I feel so fortunate to have a sangha such as ours. And I think most sanghas in the West are still early enough in our history with the Dharma that these kinds of things haven't crept in much at all. There's still, and this is what is such a blessing, to be at a time when there is still such a fresh spirit of sincerity and practice, as evidenced by the number of people who come to Sesshin, who sacrifice their vacation time. They use their vacation time and then have to be away from their families and take a hit with their income, perhaps, to come to Sesshin. It's I hope this continues and that it doesn't turn out to be in 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 years. Just a passing phase. He goes on, hammering away at these bozos. When these people see others who put an end to their wrong views, realizing their deep-rooted errors, who show true concern when they receive steady alms and treat the precepts as the true dharma of thusness, who keep their mouths shut, relaxing their wild horse minds and disregarding their monkey minds as they diligently conduct their religious practice and meticulously apply themselves sitting facing the wall in meditation, they spit, point at these people and laugh. They say these people are dull-witted and not Zen adepts. They themselves are lacking in courage. Their minds are full of pride. They talk of their long practice of Zen while they drag their juniors down the road of heresy. When a good teacher takes them on and tries to influence them to truly practice, they raise their fists, clap their hands, give a shout, and say, "Pshaw!" When a good teacher tries to grab hold of them in an attempt to discourage them, they wave their sleeves free and start to dance. This is kind of a time machine, you know, to go back and see these what goes on. They do not so much as turn their heads when they are reprimanded. They truly have an incurable disease. Medical care is of no avail. With mistaken views rooted within them, they travel around, critically questioning other Zen students who are no match for them, while their arrogant pride grows. This is what is meant by the saying, to embrace the void is to disregard cause and effect. To such confusion and recklessness invite misfortune. To beginners who have aroused the mind that seeks the way, I say, don't ever practice together with these people of mistaken views. Here, let's repeat this. This is what is meant by the saying, to embrace the void is to disregard cause and effect. This is a very real danger for people who are advanced in their practice, is having gotten some whiff of the teaching of emptiness, having seen through perhaps a lot of their thoughts and having seen maybe to some degree the emptiness of all thought constructs, all morality, all ideas, all ideals, having seen through these things, it can become attached to emptiness, to a kind of nihilism. After all, everything is empty. What does it matter? Anything goes. We can do what we want. We're free spirits. We're not like those squares who feel obliged to uphold the precepts. We're free. We're free Zen spirits. I do see in contemporary Zen in this country, teachers who take this position, the drinking and other things that go on. These are people who have not truly seen into the depths of emptiness. Because when you have, you come to confirm what we chant in the Prajnaparamita. We don't just say, form is only emptiness. We say emptiness is only form. Emptiness is the precepts. Emptiness is discipline, restraint, respecting rules and societal norms. This does worry me about contemporary Zen. And then he goes on some more. Then there are others whose whole bodies shine with clarity as the reflection of the moon shines in water. One can acquire such a kind of luminescence through development of samadhi power. But samadhi power is not enlightenment. It's not, and it's certainly not enlightenment that has integrated the realm of the precepts and the form in general. So he's talking about pretty advanced people, but they rest content with this clearly manifest light and consider it the foundation for their inherent nature. This becomes the root of their illusions. And still others ask, if all dharmas are empty, how can one practice? What teaching is there to realize? They say that when you are served tea, just drink it, and when you are served food, just eat it. They sink deeply into a shell of tranquility And looking into the koans of the ancients, they incorporate them equally into their own view of tranquility. They reason that all these sayings are without meaning. The ultimate truth, they say breezily, is that mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. Even in their dreams, they have yet to understand the wonder of Buddha nature. Some, not yet having seen into their inherent nature, have heard it said that Buddha nature is the master of seeing, hearing, and perceiving. When asked about it, they raise their hand, move their foot, and say, "This is what it is." This, by the way, as we know, has become one of these meaningless things that you hear repeated by all kinds of people in private life and people in public life. It is what it is. It is what it is. Oh, how wise. Here's the other one I hear. It's all good. It's all good. Oh, okay. Thank you for that. Others, without any understanding, call it the way of no mind. Or they think that the physical body is like a dream, a vision, or a flower in the void, and the mind is unborn and undying, always existing. Or they understand both body and mind to be illusions, which, after they dissolve into the four elements, return to the void and disappear. By the way, this is basic Buddhist teaching. But his point is that they haven't confirmed it through their own experience. They're mouthing these things. Or they consider enlightenment to be the state when one no longer doubts that all form is emptiness, which in the final analysis is the substance of the Dharma body. Or they feel that verbal expressions, no matter how few, are all mistaken. They say they will withhold their true experience of enlightenment from even their closest friend. They acquaint themselves with the occult, playing around with spirits. They say that even the clear eye do not see what they themselves can see. Then they lower their heads and whistle to themselves. Okay, we need to stop. Our time is up. We'll recite the 4 vows.